This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Today, Mel and I are interviewing Dr. Greg Sloan of Cornell University, New York State, and he works on evolved stars, dust, and the chemical evolution of galaxies. At least that's as much as I know, because I don't know all that much about what you do, so perhaps you could just tell us what kind of research you're interested in at the moment.
Well, let's see, I could tie this into the chemical evolution of galaxies, because evolved stars inject a lot of freshly processed nuclear products back into the interstellar medium. So in that sense, that's my focus, right? So in other words, these stars, they're the source of this stuff. And so I focus on them, how they die, and how they can inject the stuff back in. Because if they take a long time to go through this death process, if it's a big, long, agonizing, slow, painful process, then they can actually generate a lot more heavy elements and inject them back in. But if it goes really quick, they don't do so much for us. Okay. So it's kind of a question of, over the history of the universe, how the initial conditions of the stars have changed and how that changes what they can produce.
So to you, the stars are the things that are seeding the galaxies with the sort of materials we see around us today.
Yes. Yeah. So the really massive stars are supernovae, and they're responsible, they become supernovae, and they're responsible for a really big fraction of this enrichment. And then less massive stars like the sun, to stars up to a few times the mass of the sun, are responsible for the rest. And I've been focused on those because, the supernovae happen really quick. It's kind of hard to figure out exactly what they're doing.
Okay. And do you look mostly around in the Milky Way to see what the local galaxy is like, or are you able to look at other galaxies out there as well?
Well, we started with the Milky Way because these evolved stars are actually some of the brightest stars in the sky, especially if you look at infrared wavelengths. As you go from the optical to infrared, these stars, they start to dominate the sky. Most everything you can see in the infrared is one of these evolved stars. So that's how I started. But in the past couple of decades, as I've been going, the telescopes have gotten better and better, and we can see further and further. And so now I've been picking out individual stars in some of the nearby galaxies to the Milky Way, which has been a lot of fun because these stars they were born in very different conditions. They were born with, much more like the early primitive universe with very few heavy elements. We should probably back up. This is one point. And one of the key things that people should realize is that when the universe formed, there was pretty much nothing but hydrogen and helium. Anything heavier than that, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and all the heavier elements, you had to wait for stars to form and then die and blow the stuff back out into space before you could have any of this stuff. And so, for the first few billion years after the universe formed, if we understand this correctly now, you couldn't even make planets because you didn't have any of these heavy elements.
So everything that we see down here on Earth is all part of a recycled
process. Oh, sure.
Process.
Yeah. I always, Carl Sagan, who he actually taught at Cornell, right? And so before me, much better than me, too, I should add. But, he always likes to say things that people are made of star stuff. And this is completely true. So all the, everything besides the hydrogen in us, we don't have a lot of helium in us. Everything besides the hydrogen was all generated by stars. And you have to wait a long time from the beginning of the universe to build up enough of those heavy elements to make life, to make planets, all of that. And so this is what I'm trying to convince people to pay for my research. You always want to sort of put this in at the beginning, that this is kind of what we're trying to get at, is the enrichment history of the universe and the abundance history. But in the end, I don't really pay too much attention to the galaxies. I like looking at these stars.
Okay.
Where does the sort of the abundance, well, say for a stereotypical star after it dies, where does it reach the end of fusion? What kind of elements are we talking about it spitting out?
All right. Okay, well, just to start, so most stars, they spend most of their lifetime in what we all call the main sequence. You guys have probably mentioned that one on other podcasts, right? And on the main sequence, they're fusing hydrogen into helium. So you get less hydrogen, more helium. But then as stars, they evolve as a red giant. They're still doing that, but they can't do it in the core because the core is just inert now. And it's just all helium, and they can't make anything bigger. But then they basically go through a few bends and twists, and they finally reach this point where they're fusing helium. It takes three helium nuclei to make a carbon atom. This is a really bizarre process because it turns out you have to make beryllium, and beryllium happens to have this one state where it has a high cross section, and you can actually kind of make this leap, and you can make carbon from that. This was a really big deal when they figured this out in the early 1950s. Ed Saltpeter at Cornell mainly was kind of part of that, so I know all about this lore.
So then carbon is being formed late in the lives of the stars.
Right at the end. So more massive stars can make heavier elements. They'll make more nitrogen, they'll make oxygen, and then all the heavier stuff, for most of that, you have to look towards the really massive stars that become supernovae. But most of what's left, if you take hydrogen and helium and you remove it, most of what's left in the universe is carbon, nitrogen, oxygen. And the same is true for most of the planets around the sun. We're kind of the exception because here you see heavier stuff because there's no helium and hydrogen to dilute it, or very little.
So are we at somewhat of an exceptional kind of
on our
solar
little,
system?
On our we're an exception on our little terrestrial world called Earth.
Okay.
Right? You know, if you look at most of the mass in the solar system that's not in the sun, it's in Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune, and they're mostly made of hydrogen, just like the sun.
So finding worlds like the Earth around other stars might not be just as simple then as finding something that's in what we call the habitable zone where the temperature is right, but also the abundances of materials is important.
Well, they're hard to see, right? They're, you know, all the tricks that people use. I haven't done too much in the exoplanet hunt. It's kind of fun to look over the shoulders of some of the people who are doing it. But yeah, basically all the methods that we use to find these things are very biased towards the more massive, the Jupiters there. We're getting to the point where we can find, well, they're getting to the point where they can find terrestrial worlds, but we're not quite there yet. Getting close. Yeah, so my focus is more just looking at these stars as the machines that generate these elements that enrich galaxies, you know, in the universe.
And when you look out into the neighboring galaxies and you see that these stars are different in composition to the ones around us, why is that? Is that a selection effect, or are those galaxies actually have had a different history?
They've had a different history. So the Milky Way is very special. It's a spiral galaxy, has a disk, and in that disk there's been a lot of star formation over the past, all of them, 13.7 billion years. And so you've had a lot of star formation, so you get a lot of stars making heavy elements, and then that material forms into new stars, and so it just keeps enriching and enriching and enriching. And so we get up to what we call solar abundances. But most galaxies out there, they're not spirals, they're just ellipticals or spheroidals, and they have no disk. And so the star formation rates are much lower. In many cases, the star formation rates are pretty much zero these days. They've gone through a few episodes where they produce stars. So the enrichment history is much different. They haven't made a lot of stars, so they're much more primitive. They're much closer to the abundances, the abundance patterns that we had at the very beginning of the universe. And depending on their star formation histories, each one of these, in a way, is looking back to a different time in the early universe. And so we can look at these different galaxies and sort of use them as time machines to see what the stars would be enriching the environment around them with at different times in the history of the universe.
So is that because they are so far away that we're looking a lot back in time, or is it because those galaxies have basically stayed roughly how they are for a very long time?
These galaxies are right next door.
Okay.
In the cosmological sense of it, these galaxies are only, you know, hundreds of thousands of light years away. They're, in fact, the ones that we're looking at are considered to be in the Milky Way half of what we call the local group. So there's maybe a dozen or a couple dozen of these galaxies orbiting around the Milky Way. And then there's another similar number orbiting around M31, the Andromeda galaxy. And there's a few odds and ends to add to that, but that basically makes up the local group. And we're all within, what, a couple million light years from the Milky Way?
So nearby cosmologically.
Oh, yeah, right next door. So any redshifts you see are just because they're orbiting each other. That's not a cosmological redshift. So.
But they haven't changed, as you were saying, as much.
Yeah, they don't. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so the star formation rate's low, and so that, like as I said, right next door, close enough so that we can pick out the individual stars and actually study them fairly carefully. We have these little time machines.
So is the difference sort of entirely dependent on shape of the galaxy? It's just because we are spiral and we have a disk and we have lots of star forming regions, or is there other reasons that they won't have as much of?
Oh, that's an interesting question, and a little bit outside of my research area. So this is just, I mean, I can just kind of pass along what I think I know from going to talks and seminars and reading some of the papers. Yeah, even in a spiral galaxy, it seems like the star, there's sort of a level of star formation rate, which is certainly high compared to what you see in an elliptical. But the star formation rate, as I understand this, really is driven by mergers and encounters with other galaxies. So when one of these dwarf spheroidals comes very close to the Milky Way, for example, that might kickstart a burst of star formation, especially if it merges in. I know that at some point, M31, at some point in the distant future, we don't have to worry about when this is going to happen because it's like billions of years away, but at some point, M31, the nearest spiral and the Milky Way will merge. And when that happens, there will be a very impressive burst of star formation that'll pretty much blow everything that we're currently looking at out of the water. But and even these dwarf spheroidals, I mean, we see that the evidence appears to be that the star formation of these guys comes in bursts too, which might be a result of encounters with galaxies like our own, or maybe they got too close to each other. These are very open questions, by the way.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that you're interested in studying is dust shells around dying stars. What do those dust shells tell us, and how do you work out the information that they're giving?
Well, the dust is... It's an interesting question. The reason I started studying the dust around these stars is because it's what you can see. So a star is losing mass, right? So gas is being pushed away from the star. And as that gas cools, it actually reaches the point where it can condense into dust grains. It's very much like water vapor condensing into ice crystals in clouds here in the Earth's atmosphere. It's the same idea. Sometimes you've got water vapor, but if conditions are right, then these ice crystals will form. And so what happens is that as these stars are losing mass and the gas cools, they'll make these dust grains. And it turns out that there's a few things that happen because of that. If you have enough dust around a star, that dust completely obscures the star at optical wavelength. So these stars just drop out of the sky. And this has actually happened, you know, where stars were visible, and then there's a huge dust formation event, usually because it's in some kind of interacting binary system or something very strange, but this, you know, these dust formation events happen, and the star just gets really, really faint. The classic one is Eta Carina in the southern hemisphere. You can see this guy, and it's been through a few of these episodes. If the star drops out of the optical sky, though, that the light, all the energy that star is giving off is still being processed by the dust shell and being re-radiated at just a different wavelengths. And because the dust is cooler, it's most of this light's re-emitted in the infrared. And so as these stars drop out of the optical sky, they get very bright in the infrared. And that's why the infrared sky is dominated by these evolved stars. It's just everywhere you look, there's all these dust shells. They're just stars.
Over what sort of time scale would it suddenly drop out of the optical and flare up in the infrared?
Well, for the kind of stars I look at, it would take a while. But for some of these events, it happens over the course of a few months. You know, somebody goes out and they're kind of checking through the objects they looked at a couple months ago, and boom, that one's not there. People can go they can read a little bit more about Eta Carina. That's like the classic example. Sometime about 100, 120 years ago, just went through this dimming process. And brighter objects have done it too. Betelgeuse and Orion has produced dust episodically, and so it's gotten a little fainter here, that kind of thing.
And what does the infrared light coming from then tell us about the dust that's enshrouding them?
Well, if you look at if you break the light up and you look at it, you know, so you can see how much energy it's giving off at different wavelengths, we call this looking at its spectrum, you can tell very quickly because different types of dust emit at certain wavelengths. You know, silicate dust has a very classic signature. Carbon-rich dust has a different signature. And so we can tell very quickly, we can learn about the chemistry of the dust, which is almost always related to the chemical compositions in the star.
So are you sort of doing a bit of detective work, trying to work back from what you see in that dust cloud to what the nature of the star is or has been?
Yes, that's exactly it. In fact, it's interesting because I've made a lot of progress on certain research lines, but the question that really got me interested years ago when I was still a graduate student still hasn't been answered. There's a certain kind of a silicate-rich, or I should say oxygen-rich, silicates basically are made of one silicon atom to three or four oxygen atoms. And so silicate dust is oxygen-rich dust. And there's other kinds of oxygen-rich dust. There's alumina, and then you get crystalline versions of this dust versus the normal amorphous dust that we see. And there's some very strange dust spectra which we see in certain cases, but we've never understood why we see it there, and we still don't. It's just kind of this lingering, nagging question, which I realize, even though I've been able to write lots of scientific papers on lots of cool scientific results, that one continues to bug me.
So, I mean, we obviously use a lot of silicon here on Earth today. So is it the question of how did that get there?
On the Earth?
There's so much.
Or in space?
Well, both, I suppose. I mean, I'm assuming that at some point we've inherited that silicon from a silica disk, from another star that existed in the past.
Yeah, so if you go back and you look at the theories about how the solar system formed, right? The idea is that the planets condensed out of, you know, condensed through a process of collisions and accretion of small grains into bigger grains. And so basically the planets all came from the dust grains. Except that in the outer solar system, the dust grains were unprocessed and had mantles of lots of ices. And then they had enough mass to pull down all the gas. But in the inner solar system, the dust grains were just the silicates and just the carbon. All the ice was gone because they're too close to the sun. And so the idea is that the Earth would have formed with a lot of these heavier elements and very little of the lighter ones. That's the very simple version of events.
Mm-hmm. But you're sort of trying to work out where those elements came from or why they mm-hmm. surround certain stars.
Yeah. So the question is, you know, I said earlier, I said that anything heavier than carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen is produced in supernovae. That's the short answer. The longer answer, some of the more massive stars, which still evolve like the sun, they can produce some of these heavier elements. We know that now, if they can hang around long enough in these last phases of their life. There's a woman named Amanda Caracas, who works in Australia, who's been doing a lot of really good stuff, and then John Latanzio as well. And by the way, if I mispronounce those names, you just have to edit that part.
Okay.
But so they've been doing lots of really cool models, lots of really good models showing these more advanced nuclear reaction sequences and stuff. But these all depend on how much mass the stars have lost up to that point, because that's what's going to determine how hot the gas is inside, and that's going to determine what drives the reaction rates. And so it's all intertwined. And I'm very interested in the questions about how this dust forms, how the composition of the dust is related to the properties of the star, and then how the composition of this dust determines how much mass the star is going to lose. Because once you get the dust condensing out of the gas, the radiation pressure of the star can usually drive the whole mass loss process, but you have to cross that threshold to get there. So it's all this really intertwined series of questions, and the answer to one is interrelated to the answers to the others. So it's a big fat mess.
Okay.
And it's our job to sort of solve the puzzle one or two pieces at a time, right? You sort of assemble what we got and kind of go from there.
Would you be able to use the dust clouds to say how old so like if you were looking at a star and it was in the optical and then over a period of a couple of months it suddenly switched off and went into infrared, so you know the dust cloud has just formed. Can you tell the age of the star, or would you already need to know the mass? Is it too intertwined with other variables?
It's pretty intertwined. It's very difficult to figure out how old the star is. Typically what we do is we look, ideally we can observe some of these evolved stars in a cluster of stars. And if you have a cluster, that sort of means all the stars were formed at about the same time, and you can figure out exactly what mass the stars are that are leaving the main sequence or ending their hydrogen burning lifetime. And from that, you can figure out how old everything is. And it's pretty reasonable to assume that they're all the same age, and then you've got it. But normally, you know, if you're just looking at stars in the field in the galaxy, or even in some of these nearby galaxies, you can't do that. And it's even worse in our own galaxy, because you don't know how far away these stars are if they're not in a cluster. If they're just in the field, it's a problem. So we don't know how bright they are. We don't know how massive they are. This is another reason that drives us to look at these stars in these nearby galaxies, because we know how far away they are, which means we can work out exactly how bright they are, how luminous they are intrinsically.
And if you can make conclusions about the chemistry of those type of stars, then perhaps you can relate their stellar type to ones that are in our galaxy and kind of find out how far away they should be according to the models of what the star is.
You'd think.
I guess it's a bit complicated.
I have played some, I've played some games with trying to develop some other ways of estimating their distances. But remember, even if I've got a good method, we have a couple of them that we've worked out now. We've actually done that with some of the people who have been here at Manchester, Eric Lagadec, who was, here for a bit, and Makako Matsuura, who was here before him. Yeah, but even then, it's like plus or minus 20, 30, 40%, so we don't really know the distances very accurately at all to the galactic stars.
Well, some of the latest infrared studies I know that you use the Spitzer Space Telescope for, so maybe you could just tell us what is your favorite research project that's going on with Spitzer at the moment.
Well, so let's see, the Spitzer Space Telescope was launched in August of 2003, and it exhausted its liquid helium in May of 2009. And it's actually still going. You can do a little bit without that liquid helium, but with the liquid helium, you can cool the instruments down, and they can be very sensitive. So I did a lot of work with a spectrometer, and of course, we can't use it anymore. So at this stage, we have a lot of data which we took, really, really neat spectra of lots of different kinds of evolved stars in different locations. And so right now, I'm just working to get those data published and get those out and analyze so that people can kind of see what we learn from that. But at this stage, I'm sort of thinking about the future, because we can't do any more of this with the Spitzer Space Telescope, and the James Webb Space Telescope is still very far off in the future and somewhat uncertain at this stage. And so I have to kind of think about trying things at different wavelengths. That's what, for example, ALMA is a new frontier.
Which is longer wavelengths, almost on the way to radio.
Very much so. But that will allow us to get a better handle on what the gas is doing, because you can use ALMA. So far, we've just been studying the dust. That's what you can do in the infrared. But if you want to look at the gas, it's really good to go into to radio wavelengths, where you can see transitions, molecular transitions, and use that to trace what the gas is doing.
Is that the gas outflows?
Exactly.
From stars?
That would be the gas in the outflows from the stars.
So then if you're looking more into radio wave, does that mean you'd be able to use the Planck satellite for some of your research?
Well, Planck is, it's interesting because, of course, all of the objects we want to look at are just sort of foreground objects in the way that they have to get rid of from their sample to do what they want to do. I haven't thought too much about that. I'm not quite sure. I know that the Planck is sort of the latest version of this effort to map the anisotropies, the variations in the cosmic microwave background. One of the first experiments to do that was COBE. What did COBE stand for? The Cosmic Background Explorer? I get vague on these acronyms after a while. But COBE had a whole bunch of different detectors and experiments on it. And some of those have proven really useful to my collaborators. I've been relying on their work on this, but those are much shorter wavelengths. You could do continuum dust emission at these really long wavelengths if the dust were very, very cold. So there's stuff you could do, but for most of my objects, the dust we're interested in is a bit warmer. I know that with Herschel, some of my colleagues have been very busy looking at the cooler dust around these objects and also looking at some of the molecular transitions. But I've been busy with Spitzer data, so I've let them work on that.
Dr. Greg Sloan, thank you very much.
Well, thanks a lot for letting me go.